Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Dialogue on Ferguson, Missouri conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Instructions will be given at that time. If you should need assistance during the call, please press star zero, and an operator will be happy to assist you offline. Today's conference is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host, Professor Colin Wellenkamp. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, James. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our Dialogue on Ferguson, Missouri. We are coming to you from St. Louis, Missouri, and we have a collection of panelists on the line with us today that are going to bring, hopefully, valuable understanding and some perception from on the ground to the students that we have on the line today from St. Louis University and Washington and Venice University. Just a couple of housekeeping items. This is a co-venture between St. Louis University Department of Political Science and Washington Adventist University in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And my name is Professor Colin Wellenkamp. I'm adjunct professor at WAU for Public Policy. Joining me today is the Reverend Robert Roseboro. He's the pastor of Blessed Teresa of Calcutta Catholic Church in Ferguson, Missouri. Dr. Kenneth Warren, he is a professor of political science at St. Louis University. Charles Henson, who is a former member of the school board for Ferguson, Missouri. Keith Savage with Savage Solutions Group, whose expertise is in multicultural strategy and minority business development. Stacy Fowler, who is the Adult Services Special Projects Manager for the St. Louis Agency on Training and Employment. And then also joining us is Richard Wolf, adjunct professor of public policy, also from Washington Adventist University. So we're very excited to have these experts on the call with us today and giving us their time. What we're really trying to do is impart for our students at both these institutions and beyond is an understanding beyond what you see on CNN. Beyond what you see on cable news and the local news, for that matter, because when the satellite trucks leave and all the cameras go away to the next big story, there is still this community that is Ferguson, Missouri. And yes, there are the issues that are at the forefront of the media. Those issues are in play, but there's also much deeper issues that are of a more systemic nature of how does the community rebuild? How do these get on with their lives? Because this is, and I'm going to say R because I'm from St. Ann, Missouri, which is 2 miles from Ferguson. I grew up there. I was born and raised there. This is our home. We're staying here. We're not going anywhere with the satellite trucks. We have to get up the next morning and interact in this community that has been, I am going to use the word, devastated. And I think, Father, from your earlier analogy that you would agree with me, and I won't take that thunder away from you, that it has been devastated, and how does it recover, rebuild? What are the policy issues that are in the way of that, or what are policy issues that can help that? And we're going to talk about jobs. We're going to talk about education. We're going to talk about helping people get out of the cycle. There's many different types of cycle, but the cycle of non-value. The cycle of drudgery that they find themselves in, how does that happen? And Ferguson is relatively a small city, and it's also surrounded by cities in a similar plight. And it's in St. Louis County, and it's in the state of Missouri, and it's near the border of Illinois. So there is a regional definition to this situation, too, as well as a national. So I'm gonna start off by asking Charles Henson, who has worked in that community for the better part of his career and lives there. I am going to ask him for some historical perspective, Charles, on where we are, where we were. Because I remember the Ferguson I grew up with was on its way up. I mean, they had really made some strides. They were coming back. The 90s were good to Ferguson. They had really put some things in place to really bring their community back to life. That's one of the things, reasons I was so heartbroken to see all these things happen to it. So I'll hand it over to you, Charles, for some of that perspective, please.
Sure. So certainly, you're right. And, you know, some neat things were going on in the past 20 years. In 1994, we held probably the first of the conferences on diversity in the city of St. Louis, I think, on the campus of Florissant Valley. We were patterning that after the Oak Park neighborhood in Chicago, which had a long historic big experience with diversifying a community. And we held our conference here. And in 1995, that was in October of 94, in January of 95, we formed a group called PRAP, People Reaching Out for Unity and Diversity. And it was far-reaching and it was broad, and we looked at everything from city services to the government to education, and we started people to dialogue and a conversation around diversity and inclusion. And that was in itself, I mean, a whole paradigm shift differently from around the country. And it was so readily received that we were, during the Clinton administration, they acknowledged our group on their website as being a promising practice in the country. And so we worked for a number of years bringing people together, of everybody, from the clergy, from the public, from education, the neighborhoods, and the talk and dialogue about those things that we're typically uncomfortable about talking about. And what happened was the insurgent, people started to stay. Certainly there was economic flight, but we started to adopt the conversation. I'm sure Father Rosie remembers this. If you want to leave, go. But we've got something here special, and people stayed around. And if you looked at the city of Ferguson, if you go down that two-mile stretch of Florissant Road, and you see the development, and there's new businesses and buildings being built, and people were encouraged about doing things. And so for the next 16, 17 years, that discussion continued, and people talked. And I think unfortunately, what happens, like being in business, when you've got a relationship with a good business and then they change the players, I think players changed. And so some of that process and some of the ideology, because there are sacrifices to really accept inclusion and to be comfortable with it, and you have to adopt something. It's not, you can't just say wake up the next morning and it happens. You really have to continue. And I think the players started to change. And there was so much excitement around the visual development that I think we lost a little focus on the personal and social aspect of what that really meant. And so when you look at, there's some obvious disparities just in our small town with regard to employment and the number of faces of color when you look at compared to the neighborhood. The same thing happens in the school system, the school board. You know, you've got one minority in a district that's 85% or better African American. So I think those disparities really kind of don't work to our advantage, because things like what we saw happen can happen. And the unique thing is that there's opportunities in this. City of Ferguson has the opportunity, with the support of surrounding neighbors, community stakeholders, whoever, to develop a model that can be echoed around the country. Because what happened here can happen anywhere in this country. Because everywhere that I've been and talked about, whether it was traveling with different school boards around the nation, people talked about there's a culture there and there's some folks there that don't always fit in to the mainstream or whatever culturally or they're received or whatever properly and things like that. So this kind of situation can happen anywhere. We were just unfortunate that it happened in our community. But I think we need to look at the positive things that can come out of this. And these kind of discussions is where it all starts. So there's grassroots people who are talking to me right now that we're going to be meeting to talk about something we did over that 17-year period. We were encouraged by Focus St. Louis to host Courageous Conversations. And we found the biggest impact in doing just that. So we're going to start looking at that again. Courageous Conversations, where you bring people of different representative samples of around the community, sit them at a table, and let's talk about it. Let's hear your story. Let's talk about how you got to where you are and what's your thought process on that. Nobody's held to blame. Everything is out and open. It's an honest discussion. Let's talk about it. And because unless we can do that, and that's what we have to do. And we started doing that in the district as well. start talking about, look, walk a mile in my shoes, and then we can start to really dialogue and have a good time.
Can I focus in on something you said there? You said you were able to really craft some momentum over a 17-year period for the area, and people were staying, people were coming back into the area, and it was really experiencing a sort of renewal.
Yeah.
And then something turned, something happened. Could you zero in on that for us when you think, or what you think,
sure,
were some of the causes of why the momentum started to slow down?
I think a couple things happened. First part of when I talked about the players changing and administration politically, that started to change. Also, I think people started to get comfortable with the visual aspect that we're fixed, we're healed.
Mm-hmm.
We don't, you know, that discussion is kind of boring now. Why keep talking about it? Look, we're doing good. You know, the bars are filled, the restaurants are filled, and everything else is happening, and you start to get complacent about the whole process. But it really comes down to that social construct, acceptance and inclusion. You know, I think when officers are just, for instance, I mean, the white privilege whole conversation and understanding and respecting that exists, when we can see each other as you see yourself, that's when we can have the difference. When whites can see me as you see, they see themselves. So, you know, I say that, and that's really where it echoes. That's really where the sentiments need to be handled, that you got to see me as you see yourself. And when we can get to that, I mean, for instance, just simple as this. If there's a situation to where I'm being threatened, or whatever, personally, African-American man, and there's a white woman there, or whatever, or see me in some kind of situation that maybe I need some support or help, what would you do if that was your brother? What would you do if that was your neighbor who looked like you, who was white and looked like you, and vice versa?
Mm-hmm.
Those are kind of the simple aspects, because then it changes the whole idea of what your involvement in intervention is.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
This particular incident, I just had a discussion recently about the Michael Brown issue with a white lady, and she was saying that I was talking about the unfortunate nature of a body laying in the street for 4.5 hours. And her conversation was, well, it was process, it was protocol. They were waiting on St. Louis County to get in. I said, look, hold on. If that was your son or daughter, how would you feel? And she got quiet. Total different scenario. There is no way, I know personally, had that been my baby lying in the street, there's no way you would have stopped me from getting to that body and comforting that body. But to hold those parents out, to say, no, you can't, we're waiting on somebody, or not cover their body, and also for the neighborhood, that was an insensitivity to feeling, because you wouldn't do that in your own neighborhood. You wouldn't do that if it was your family member.
Right.
And that just heated the public. Heated the public. I wasn't there when I heard about it. I said, no, that can't be true. Until I started seeing the videos and things like that. That was the most insensitive thing that I've ever seen in my life. We can't allow that kind of stuff to happen. Because even if it was protocol that they were waiting on, sometimes you got to put that rationale aside for the best interest of the people, the public, the family, whoever, to make, you know, things happen. Covering a body wouldn't take a whole lot.
That's right. Well, and you, those are some very powerful statements. So, and I hadn't heard it crystallized like that to date. So, thank you very much. And I want to turn to Dr. Wolf, who's on the phone, with something you just said, Charles. And that was, in that turn when we lost the momentum, you said the bars were being filled, the restaurants were being filled, people were buying houses, things were going good. But you said the word, it was a facade. The underlying issues were not being addressed. Some of those are underlying issues are policy-driven issues. Some of them are political issues. But they're there, and they continued, as you say, to fester, and then they resulted in the things that you just talked about, which was a travesty. So, Dr. Wolf, I turn to you on some of those things that Charles mentioned on, it looked to everybody that things were on their way up. We don't really need to work any harder than we are. Things are looking good. Maybe they were for a few folks, but there are other things in the way and systemic issues that remain. Maybe they're policy driven, maybe they're fed by policy problems, but I will hand that one to you. What do you think you could put your finger on as some of those problems?
Well, I was moved by your comments, certainly. At one point, I read a comment, which is, before every breakthrough, there's a breakdown. And it may be that this whole event is a clear example of a breakdown. But my hope is that the dialogue that we're having today and the dialogue we'll continue to have will be a breakthrough to a better tomorrow. It strikes me that one of the things that was underlying your comments was the concept of dignity, and that people need dignity in their lives. They need to be treated with dignity. And it doesn't sound like dignity was incredibly important at that point, and I think that is a major problem. In talking about the general situation that you're dealing with, we were talking earlier, we had a meeting earlier today, and we were talking about the fact that for individuals, it's hard to have dignity when you don't have prospects and you don't have a sense of control over your own future. So one of the things that I've learned after several years of working in communities is that the people who are most involved and concerned about the future of their community are the people who live there. And that it's important that those people take the most interest, because other people coming from other places will soon find other things to be involved with. But as Colin said, this is your home. This is where you live. And that the consequences of actions which may have been taken for good reasons can often lead to long-term issues. One night of fires can result in 40 years of burned-out homes and businesses, and we've all seen that. And so I think it's important for us to focus on the people of the area, what their needs are, and can we constructively move ahead to develop solutions to their problems. And one of those problems is personal dignity and the ability to find work that's meaningful in their lives.
And that's a perfect segue into what we'll be talking about in a few minutes, creating real change. And I want to hand it, give Keith and Stacy that piece if we can. But before we get there, I think I'd like to stay on some of this, on some of the systemic issues that we're facing and looking at that Charles described brilliantly and that Dr. Wolf gave an overlay to, and then Professor Warren. You've studied these issues, and you've done a lot of data gathering around these issues and charted their path through American ethos. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on maybe some of the underlying, more systemic issues that may be in play that led to where we are, unfortunately, in the reality that Charles just described.
Well, one systemic issue, of course, pertains to education. And when you look at the educational system that Michael Brown graduated from, scores have just been come in from the state where the school district received only a 7% approval rating from the state board, as opposed to white affluent districts that are getting 95 to 100%. I see institutional and process racism a serious problem in America as a whole. I've studied the problem very seriously. It has an impact on voting behavior. Obama definitely, for instance, lost in Missouri because of a racist vote against him. That was very measurable.
And when you say measurable, how was that
measurable in terms of public opinion polls? Most studies have shown, carried out by Professor Tesler, for instance, who has measured this along with many other professors nationwide, found that you have overt racism that accounts for about 5 to 6% of racist voting. In other words, people said, I voted against that person because that person was black. You also have what's called psychological racism, where people voted against the person but because of the person's race, but they give other reasons for that. That's more difficult to measure. I think one problem is actually a problem in the black community, and they must take fault for that,
and that is the political representation. I've done, as a local professor close to Ferguson, I've done a lot of interviews with the media. One of the main things that they've asked me, surprisingly, because they looked up the statistics on Ferguson, they would say, how can a community that is two-thirds black have almost no black representation? That was perplexing to me, and actually I asked my black friends, one Russell Gunn, who was a former state rep representing that area, and he said, Ken, they don't vote. Well, why don't they vote, Russell? Because they don't feel they have a stake in the community. We were just met with stakeholders, and I was wondering when that was being discussed, do African-American residents of Ferguson feel that they have a stake in the community? Because they are registered to vote, by the way. Only in an article appearing in the Post-Dispatch, an op-ed piece written by a colleague of mine, Todd Swanstrom, who co-authored this article, mentioned that in the presidential election, only 1% fewer blacks voted in that election, 55 to 54%. But in the municipal election, only 7% voted, compared to 17% for the white community. Of course, you know, voting in local local elections is low anyway. But on the other hand, what the African-American community needs to do to help resolve this problem moving forward is that they have to organize, they have to get black leaders to step out, they need to run for office, and they need to get out and vote, because with 2/3% black in that community, they could change that very quickly. Now, how would that impact the community? That means that they could set the political agenda in Ferguson. They could not have a police force with only 3 blacks out of 53. That is amazing to the reporters calling in. They can't even relate to that. Having a white mayor, having a city council with only one black representative. So I think that's one thing the black community needs to do. They need to take responsibility for organizing in Ferguson and developing a political leadership structure where they are going to be represented and they're going to set the political agenda.
If I may.
Stacy?
Let me add one more caveat, which I haven't told you all. I was an alderwoman in Pine Line, which is one of those small municipalities, for 6 years. So let's talk about politically, how does that happen?
Could you say where that is for the students?
Pine Line is probably
northeast of Ferguson.
Southeast of Ferguson. It's a small municipality, kind of like Ferguson. Actually, it's a little smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But I had the largest ward, and trying to get organized and have, you know, that what you call political machine behind you, you don't have that. It becomes an economic issue in terms of really being able to get out and get people to support and even open their doors and talk to you. Because in their minds, and I hate to say it, they sometimes think that the system is broken and they're not going to receive anything from that system. It kind of goes back to the stakeholders meeting of trust, and that the same people get in and they do nothing and they see none of the results that they want to see.
What motivated them to turn out for Obama and not in the municipal election?
He was black. It was the chance to get a black man in the White House.
Okay.
And change.
And change
was promised. And they thought that they really could get some of that change. And they have gotten some of that change. But then there's been a really big pushback even on him to do some of the changes that they want to do. So, you know, it's a balancing act. You're always going to have that pull and tug, that political process of really trying to get things accomplished.
If I may, this is Keith Savage with Savage Solutions Group. I've had the privilege to work for a governor for 2 terms. I've had the privilege of working for a mayor for the past 12 years as an advocate. And let me just share with you, it doesn't work that easy always in the political arena, because you got to remember something. That's just one candidate. And he's got to get policies and legislation through to help his constituents. In Missouri, you have rural versus urban. For instance, They passed a law in Jefferson City that if you had a car on a farm with no title, it could be towed away because of his age. Well, that law affected urban St. Louis, and it increased car thefts because most minorities drive anything from 1996 and below. So they could take those cars to the junkyard and scrap them. But here's the main reason why no one votes in the black community, because leadership, whether it's black, white, Asian, Jewish, or whatever, has failed them because they do not know how to go in and negotiate up front. I've been in meetings where other cultures have talked to the candidate and said, you do this for us, we'll support you. If not, if you get in, we'll take you out.
Right. And that's what you mean by negotiating up front?
Right. Negotiate up front. We need better education. We need better health care. The black community does not go and ask requests. We have a congressman here that showed up after the governor. But all you heard about was the governor showed up late. So it doesn't work. It doesn't work because we are not vocal. So voting, if we're not vocal, voting is being vocal. So we don't vote and we don't ask for anything.
Well, the other thing to piggyback onto that, some of the reasons is who we talked about earlier, is that trust factor and belief that my voice is going to make a difference.
And my vote makes a difference.
And my vote, and let me tell you, we had a big failure in the city of Ferguson and Florissant this past year when we allowed the all-white school board to remove the best superintendent in the state of Missouri for no apparent reason other than they just didn't like him. And we allowed that to happen. And
when did that happen?
That in November of last year.
Okay.
They said they put him up, just put him out on
data breach.
Well, no, it wasn't that. It was just a lack of philosophy at start.
Mm-hmm.
And then data breach came up, probably the third excuse.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened? I was there on that school board and saw some of the dissension around that man not allowing that gentleman to do what he was really capable of doing. And when I left that school board, they basically went after him. And here's the point. At the first school board meeting, after the announcement of this gentleman being put on waivers or whatever you would say, 1,500 people showed up to the board school board meeting.
One time.
But wait a minute. But they showed up, okay? That was probably 10 times the size of a normal school board meeting. And what happened was these were elected officials. That they came out of invoice, said, we don't like what you did, you need to change it. You're supposed to pay attention to what the public says to say. They didn't. So that started to, again, erode the whole idea that my vote means anything or my voice means something.
Well, yeah.
Because they came out in numbers.
Right.
And the numbers on the second next board meeting wasn't as much, but it was at least half that amount of people.
Right.
But still, no changes.
But see, that's my point. Keith was saying they voted for Obama because he was black. Okay, I understand. I've studied why blacks do not turn out and vote for candidates. When I testified in court on Clay, for instance, you could see people coming out and voting like crazy, African Americans, for Clay, and then the drop off was enormous, as much as going down to 40% not voting for whites running against whites on the ballot.
Bill Clay.
But the point is if you get a credible, qualified black leader, yes, they're going to come out and vote for that person because that person's black, and they're going to see that their vote's going to count for something.
But that word
they have
you
an
said,
opportunity to elect
qualified, quality leader. Those things are missing in the black community. We have no black leadership here. We have none. Where is it?
Well, it's hard for me.
You can go have a chicken dinner. I know, but you can go have a chicken dinner with the NAACP. You can go have a chicken dinner with the Urban League, and they do some great things. But where are the leaders?
Well, you have to find them. That's the challenge.
You're all talking about is community engagement and on-the-ground community work. And if I can turn to you, Father Rosie, who's been there sort of doing that sort of work, at hearts and minds, if you will, I'd like your perception on that.
Well, there's one other side before I talk about the parish. I have talked to the different people in the last couple of years. We don't give up power easy. I don't care who you are. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you want a full community, you have to give up some of your power to help develop leaders who are there. Every block has leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And people on the blocks know who the leaders are.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't tend to develop them
right.
at the next level because we may lose our power.
Mm-hmm.
It's called
yeah.
preservation.
Yeah.
And that part is actually works against itself.
Yeah.
And that's what happens in Ferguson. You talk about, I've been there 9.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I love the community. I love the people. And yet the this connection you're talking about, Chuck, is really a sadness. And yet it's interesting, meanwhile, you talk about you know, how do we get go on the next step. And I call it the earthquake of Napa Valley, that people think it's all finished. There's still aftershocks. There are people still shook up by what took place 3 or 4 weeks ago. People whose lives were all altered by that one moment, and instead of going to bed in trouble, they had a gun next to the bed.
Mm-hmm.
And said, I'll sleep with my family, protect my family. Whether it's rational, emotional difference, it's real for them. And they're shook. There are people who had homes next to West Florissant and Road that I had parishioners who were scared to death. That what happens if the grand jury does not produce mm-hmm. what they want? What happens to their homes? What happens to their home values?
Yeah.
What happens to their peace of mind? And so there's still aftershocks. And those who say, this is a great opportunity, but they have not stopped shaking themselves at what it means to their own hearts. And you're talking about where do we begin now? And I'm a spiritual leader for 3,000 people, and I have they comprise of 9 communities,
mm-hmm.
including 5,000 people in unincorporated areas of St. Louis County.
Mm-hmm.
So I have all of Berkeley, all of Calverton, all of Cool Valley, all of parts of Narmony, parts of Florissant, Darwin Courts, parts of Hazelwood, all of Ferguson, Delwood. That's my parish.
Wow.
52,000 people. And so how do I minister to them? And my approach is, first of all, I don't have a quick answer. If I had the answer, I'd have given it a long time ago. But in prayer, we need to get in touch with the Lord to say, we're shook up, our body's still shaking, but what does the Lord say to us in our own hearts? And how do we respond then? Do we run away? Some will do that. Some young parents are parents of people in St. Charles now whose parents live in our area said, they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
I can't stop them. I don't want my mama shaking in her boots. I don't want my mama shaking in her bed, afraid to close the door at night. Well, I'm going to lose them. And I cry over that because I want the next step, which is realize what we have not done and how we set into motion a healthier community to make Ferguson more full and diverse and help develop leaders who are natural leaders there, but we haven't given the tools or called them forth to say, we challenge you to be a stakeholder, not just in name, but in essence. That's
wow.
That's incredibly powerful. I'm almost speechless. It's been it's been a very powerful dialogue, and I want to end on a good note and a note of action before we open it up to questions. And I want to hand it over to Keith Savage and Stacy Fowler for that to talk about. We've talked about how we got here with Charles, and we've talked about people's behavior and some of the systemic issues and impediments with Dr. Wolf and Dr. Warren. And we've talked about the characteristics of hearts and minds on the ground after the earthquake, as it were, after this event took place. And it might be over for CNN, but it's not over for all of us that live here and for the folks that have to grapple with this. And apparently, it's not over for other people in the country either, because the city of Minneapolis was in the news this morning of some of the things that they are dealing with some of the same issues. So these are, and it was on the news this morning, these are some of the aftershocks that you're talking about, Father. So how do we, nuts and bolts, Stacy, Keith, how do we create an environment in which we can build off of, an environment where we can take control of our lives again, we can begin to heal this community, not just in healing in song and ceremony, but healing in creating better, sustainable, for creating better lives for people and addressing some of these situations.
Well, I'll start out. Stacy gave me the floor, and I was doing ladies first. There was a community once where there were successful black entrepreneurs, and it was called the Black Wall Street. That's been one of my lifelong goals, to create that here in St. Louis. But when you look at Ferguson, the minority population, the black population there, does not have the credit score to work with the bank to get the capital, not even the SBA. They do not have financials. Those small mom-and-pop shops, they don't have the financials that's required. So they're going into a community to give low-interest loans and no-interest loans to people who don't have the right qualifications. So how do you change that? Well, you have to be more flexible. For instance, the city of St. Louis is putting together a construction consortium fund where banks have come in to loan money to construction companies, minority and women-owned, that are high risk. They can't get bonded. They can't get loans. Now we've also brought in the bonding component. Giving people, father, you know better, what is it? You teach a man to fish, but you can give them a fish or can teach a man to fish, right?
Option.
Yeah, if you teach them to fish, they'll eat longer. So there's that sustainability forever.
Right.
So there's going to have to be some flexibility. Do you realize there are 15 million people in the United States with bad credit? But somehow, others, well, I was being kind.
I think you were
15 million. Yeah. I was being kind. You young people with credit cards, you better listen.
I'm doing it.
Yeah. But no, think about it. What do? Instead of changing the rules of credit scores, they increase the interest rate if you have bad credit to continue to put you in a hole. This community cannot be forced to continue to be put in a hole. There has to be changes. For instance, one of the things, if you want to make change, go to the prosecuting attorney and say, dismiss all non-felony warrants and fines and court fees for people so they can get a job. Don't take the money. Dismiss them. But how are you going to do that when most of their budget comes from that?
Right.
So I've got a person making minimum wage, barely making it, with kids, in Section 8, so I got to give my money to Aldi's, the grocery store, my kids, and to the city of Ferguson. Bad equation. So that is part of a change. So you take the legal entity, you take the leadership entity, and you start them to show change, and the community will change.
I agree with that. I wholeheartedly agree with that. But also, as you're teaching them how to fish, they need employment. They need a job. They need to be able to provide for their family. They need the education to improve their skills so they can get a better paying job. So, you know, I understand unemployment is an issue, but we have a lot of underemployed individuals who are not really making livable wages to be able to really be able to take care of themselves and their families. And that's where we begin to start to make change. That's where we begin to start working with individuals one by one, beginning to make the community better and change the community and allow those individuals to reclaim their community back and begin to rebuild them and their community at the same time.
And I think there's a strong argument for us to support that, but people need to buy into that, and that when every segment of the community is made whole with regard to employment, it really does reverberate throughout the community.
It does.
Everybody benefits by everybody being employed, that are employed.
And it might not even be the best job, but it's
no.
The starting part. Point. You have to start somewhere. You got to start with what you've got and then build on that. It might not be the greatest job, but as long as it's making wages and giving you income so that you can take care of you and your family, that's where the starting point begins.
Because employment gives you self-worth.
It does.
And that's
and
what
it
it's all about.
And it helps with self-esteem, self-efficacy, all of it.
Right.
And people do vote if their jobs are being impacted.
Yeah. Right.
I work on a lot of river issues, right, and I work a lot with the Mississippi River, and that river generates $200 billion a year and a lot of in annual revenue for the United States. And a lot of the political bandwidth around that river are the jobs that are associated with that river. And the jobs speak to, well, this is going to impact my job, and I like my job. All right, you know, my job does a lot for me. I'm going to act on that. I'm going to act in that connection. You wouldn't believe the amount of mobilization that you can mobilize around something like the Mississippi River. And why? Well, it's because of the jobs that depend on the river, moving freight, longshoremen, all the ports and terminal people, all the energy, agriculture, recreation jobs that are associated with it. So if you have if people connect their job with their political engagement.
And their community.
And their community, well, improvement of, right? Then they tend to act quite readily. Quite readily.
What percent of African Americans own houses in Ferguson versus the white community?
The statistics, I can't remember the last one.
I don't know, but it's a pretty good substantial number of folks. There's certainly some. Everybody talks about the people who are very mobile
and transient, in and out of the community.
But that's not the issue in Ferguson. I don't think that is not.
You probably have more homeowners.
You've got more homeowners.
Because there's more homeowner stock.
There is significant homeowner stock.
Versus other parts of the community that would allow for you to have renters and transient individuals in apartments and that kind of stuff. You really have homes. More so than apartment complex. They're in pockets, but I think that there's way more homes.
Because that's one of the things we looked at over the years. I mean, depending on, there was enough diversity in the quality of homes in the city of Ferguson that really supplied, there was just for a number of people, depending on where your social class was and things like that, and it became an economic thing because homes would go from $35,000 to $300,000 in one community, you know, and that's possible. And so that gave a lot of diversity and created. So we certainly got the pockets of transient and very mobile people, but it's going to always be that way.
But see, homeowners vote, as you know, at a much greater rate than renters. And then when you look at a 7% turnout, you have to pose the question, how many homeowners are turning out and voting? I mean,
But here's what you're missing.
Mm-hmm.
What are they picking from? I mean, so I've been in politics for 20-something years, and there's a machine. And the machine knows how to get out the vote. The machine has a qualified candidate, and the machine knows what it takes to win. If you're up against a machine, you're not going to get that member on the school board. You're not going to get that member as a police commissioner. You're not going to get that member as a mayor because it goes back to education. You're not educated about the political process because you're not involved.
Also, that machine can be very manipulative to the folks who are not aware of that. Because I'm going to tell you, I was the first African-American to run for city council in the city of Ferguson.
Ever?
Back in the 90s, early 90s.
Ever?
Ever. The first.
Wow.
And it was new for me, the whole political agenda. Rena, okay? I was in there as one of the candidates, first black candidate, and then all of a sudden another black candidate showed up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
To divide the vote.
And the gentleman that encouraged this other black gentleman to get in the race waited till the last day and got in himself, a white gentleman. He won.
Mm-hmm.
That machine is very manipulative and very complicated if you don't know. So that machine has ways of working against, and so people then lose that. If you don't understand what happened, people lose the confidence in that vote,
being able to see it making a difference for them in the community.
So you asked me about creating real change. This morning I met with the past mayor of the city of St. Louis, Vince Schemel, and he was one of the few people of non-color that got it. There is a lack of communication when it comes to between African American and Caucasian. I could sit in the boardroom of one of my boards that I'm on and say A, B, C, D, but one of my other board members, a majority Caucasian, can say A, B, C, D, and everybody goes, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And I stopped the meeting like, what did I say different? No, I do, because if I'm speaking like woo, I need to know.
Right.
I speak English, not Ebonics, you know. So although I'm respected, but do you respect my opinion?
And what I have to present.
And what I have to present. So in this community of Ferguson, someone said it here best, they weren't respected. They had no input. And even if they voted, they were frustrated with the outcome. And when 1,500 people come into an auditorium that can elect you or remove you, and you still dismiss them, that crushes people.
Mm-hmm.
That why am I voting?
It's easy to say, why? Yeah, why do it?
Why do
it? What's going to change?
But it goes back to sustainability, building leadership,
mm-hmm.
and voicing your opinion, not just at the voting box, but come together with a strategy and a plan and take it to city leaders and say, this is what we would like to see. What would it take to get this done? We will be stakeholders in this process. But there's the lack of education or the lack of caring to execute
right.
in the black community.
Well,
I understand that, and that's
okay.
what has to be developed.
Right. But how do you develop that?
I know. It's not that easy. I understand the machine you're going up against as well. Machines can be overcome, but, again, it takes education. It takes,
and it takes
strong community leaders.
And it takes money.
Most important is, in our politics many times, it's confrontive.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
What you have is the numbers,
and that's not what we need.
Yeah.
Right.
When I'm in your face to put you down,
yeah.
or to say I'm going to wipe you out,
yeah.
then the person says, I have a choice to leave in this area or stay here, the business may order, and then that's a win.
Yeah.
That to me, if that is done in Ferguson, you lose an economic base.
Yes. Yeah.
Because confrontative does not win long term.
No.
Look at our politics and culture.
It's got to be committed.
I would like to give the students on the phone a chance to ask questions. the fantastic dialogue, great points, but I do open it up to questions that the students may have. Operator James, we are ready to take questions. If you want to remind folks how to do that and queue up.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press *1 on your touch-tone phone. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if anyone would like to ask a question, please press *1 to get into the question queue. We have a question from Vinton Wilson in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Your line is open.
Hello, hi. This is Vincent Wilson. I have a question. In regards to what you guys can do as far as the job, you saying that they need a job opportunities there. Do you think that maybe, well, I know from even where I'm from in Springfield, Massachusetts, it's not a lack of jobs but a lack of wanting to work and a lack of the desire to do something better with your life. Do you think that there's anything positive in the community that we could do to maybe share the value of work? I believe someone said that a job gives you purpose or a job gives you career. I don't know if I'm quoting you correctly. But I was wondering, what could we do to make people even excited about working and about having a job making money the legal way?
That's a fantastic question.
That's very good. You get it. You get it so much. You know, people have become disenfranchised. They have separated themselves from the system. They have pushed back because so much has happened to them. We've lost their trust. We've lost their respect because they don't feel they can get anything from us. So they just drop totally out of the whole process. And it's our responsibility, if we want to turn this community back around, is to help them know that that does make a difference. They do have a purpose. They can realize whatever those dreams were that they had. And you do run into a lot of people who just say, I can't do it. I don't want to do it. I'm just going to stay on my assistance, and I'm just going to live my life the way I want to live it. But they don't realize that they can even live a better life. But, you know, sometimes we have to take them by the hand and show them. And it is a step-by-step process. And it doesn't happen overnight. And you can't put a big Band-Aid on it because it'll be festering under there. You got to really work it.
Well, I'd like to chime in, young man. It's called work ethic, and it's something that's not learned but developed.
And taught.
I guess you do. Yeah. Like grandma. Yeah. My grandfather taught me when I asked for a dollar one day. He says, "You know, how old are you?" I said, "I'm 10." He goes like, "I'll be right back." And he came back with a plastic bag. And he says, "You can get a box or a bag. Go get some soda bottles. You get a nickel for every soda bottle." So it tells you how old I am, because you're taking a Coca-Cola. And, you know, I made my money that way. And I started a detail shop at the age of 13, and I called it washing cars. So it's a work ethic thing. And how do you do that when you're up against fast money in the community?
Yeah.
You know, think about it. A drug dealer, because I talked to a few of them. They understand inventory management.
Oh, yes.
Accounts payable. Accounts receivable.
Supply-demand.
How to develop a market. And how to what
distribute?
How to distribute?
Recruit?
How to get the customers hooked?
How to manage the inventory? What house to put it in? What building to put it in? What bank to put it under? So think about it. They took those traits, but here's the thing, young man. And I've been through this at a young age. When you go to work, you got to put up with other elements.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that answered your question.
Almost definitely.
Hello? Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much, Vincent.
The other thing on that, too, is this. We can tend to judge people who have a different ideology about work ethics than us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I had some upbringing. You had a grandfather who did whatever. We who have strong work ethic, there was somebody who helped you gain that.
Oh, you better believe it.
It just didn't come natural.
It was somebody's.
Yeah. We all have a response. We failed a lot of these people. You know, the established
how to reach back and bring.
How to reach back.
We have.
It's because it's easier to make the downtrodden feel worse and say you just this and that, and we make a judgment. Don't judge them, because we didn't decide, nobody in this room ever decided where your parents, who your parents were going to be, what culture was going to be brought in, what situations you're going to be born into.
That's a good point. James, we're ready for another question.
And ladies and gentlemen, if anyone else would like to ask a question, please press star 1 to get into the question queue. Okay, the next question is from Rick Gary from St. Charles, Missouri. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. I am a brief background. I was born in 1951 in the great state of South Carolina. And when I hear the reason for not voting, It infuriates me. The reasons are that you people that got killed, and perfectly legitimate reason, are that their vote don't think they're going to accomplish anything, or not, there's no one to vote for. But that's not how voting works. If you want to accomplish something, you first vote. I recall when I was hearing this, I recall the Cheney, Sherman, and Goodman. You know, those names ring to me. The 13, 14, 15, Plessy, Brown, the Voting Rights Act, those things ring to me. And to hear that we are giving excuses for not voting, and this is why I hear excuses, is totally foreign to someone like me who was raised in South Carolina, transferred here in 1980. But that's one side. So I can rant and rage about that all day long.
Let me say this. You experienced history. Think about this. Sometimes when I'm in a Chinese restaurant in my community, because I do live among my people in North St. Louis, high crime rate and everything, I have an alarm. But but here's the thing. Most kids today don't know that history, that the water hose thing. You know when they see it? In February. And that's if they're not looking at cable.
Or Black History Month.
Or Black History Month is it. So they don't understand what we had to do, or our ancestors had to do, to have the right to vote.
Let's be clear, too. We don't condone the excuses. We just have identified what
they
are.
What the excuses are, yes.
We definitely don't like them either. We don't like them either. You know what I'm saying? But
I get that, but, you know, from someone like me, and I hear this not just from you, but I hear this from, well, my vote don't count. Well, you're right. If you don't vote, it doesn't count. So,
that's good.
But it's something that I'll get off my rant. I can ramp around all day.
Okay.
But I don't know whether or not this actually occurs in Ferguson, but I live in St. Charles, but also I work in a little beautiful town in St. Charles called Connellville, St. Charles. The pride in that community is unbelievable. In fact, I work there, so I'm very proud of the fact that I work there. But again, I don't know whether this happens, but this, what's surprising to me is that people are surprised that this took place in some place like Ferguson. Because to me, it's apparent that the people who are authorized to keep order in the community, who see the community as the other, and the community see them as the occupying force. Does the police department sponsor any Boy Scouts association? Do they have baseball, football leagues? Do they do anything to interact with the community?
No.
Do they do anything to actually say, hey, people in this community, kids in the community, elementary kids? I remember when I was in high school, the police officer, this is Greenville, South Carolina, police officer in the police department came down and tried to encourage people to go into law enforcement. And it was a whole different dynamics because I saw the police differently, but also the police saw us differently because once they began to interact with the students, we were not the enemy. There may be some bad people, but they were just bad people, but not everybody was bad. So,
that's a good point. Well, let me share this with you. Most of the police that police Ferguson did not live in the community, so they had no vested interest. And the other problem is most of the police now are more. Here's the scary part that I found out. So you're asking about how the police can be more involved in the community. Most police departments are getting veterans from the Afghanistan war. Now, can you imagine I have a friend who was in Afghanistan in Iraq. He could not go outside. He had to go to the hospital. He has to go to the hospital every 4th of July. Can you imagine if the wrong sound had went off in someone's head of one of those policemen that had the SWAT rifle? Those are the ones they hire from the military. And the wrong button was pushed. The situation could have been worse. So when you say, where is that police department encouraging others to be a part of the community, they don't live there.
Well, you know, hold on. Let me say.
See if there's more questions.
Let me say something about City of Ferguson. There was, at one time, a strong community policing program.
In Ferguson. Okay.
You know, we had officers out on bicycles. We actually raised money. Individual organizations like our Proud Group donated money for the police officers to buy bikes, to be visual, to be, you know, touch and feel more of the public. Mm-hmm. And those programs and players change. And so those programs go away because, you know, it's too comfortable. We get complacent. Our community doesn't need that anymore. Or we start talking about the funds are not available, but we can fund a concert.
Yeah,
we can't fund.
Right,
community
we can get a tank.
Right, all right.
Okay. James, are there any other questions?
We have no further questions.
Okay, I would like to ask Charles real quick. We do have some wash over time that's available in case we get some more questions. did you fund some of that through the COPS program, the federal program, the community-oriented policing program?
I'm certainly some of that was funded.
Okay, well.
Because there was a strong push across the nation.
There was, yeah.
You know, City of Ferguson certainly bought into that.
Right.
And started doing that process, and officers were trained, and,
right.
And we got them out, got them in the streets and things like that. And it worked. But like across the nation, we started talking about budget issues.
Yeah.
Right.
And cut this.
Yeah. And the COPS program was cut as well, 25%.
Yeah.
It was cut dramatically. And you said the actors changed. Well, you got to have somebody that's willing to go out and try and get the money.
Right. In business today, the one thing we know to be successful in business, what do you have to create? Relationships.
Oh, yeah.
Relationships. So if the relationship is in severed between the authority and the public.
Right.
That's a poison pill.
Yeah, you know, I think that's what our caller Vinton was talking about from Massachusetts. One of the things how do we get people excited about improving their lives legitimately? And one of the things is getting them in touch with the right folks, like professionals like yourselves, getting them the right relationships would sort of foster, this is why you really want to do this. These are, and I just to disclose to everybody on the call, and some of the participants have alluded to this, we had a stakeholders meeting right before the call. Everybody that's in this room now was part of that meeting, and that meeting's point was to try and develop a preliminary plan by which we can engage not just Ferguson, but the Ferguson is in a sea of communities. Just so you, if you folks can visualize this, it is landlocked and it's surrounded by other municipalities. And in the St. Louis region is 3.1 million people, so you're talking about a pretty populous region with eastern Missouri and western Illinois. About a plan, Keith, that would try to bring companies to the fold, that would be interested in training these folks that want to improve themselves and offering them better opportunities than what they have now. It looked like you came away with a pretty good blueprint forward.
Well, it's common sense. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel. And like I said earlier today, before Ferguson, the community was calm. There was no urgent need to do anything. And now they're like, what do we need to do? And they're going to throw money into a little bitty square instead of the entire region. Because you have to realize, Ferguson was the epic center of what's been going on around the nation. And that's what I've been telling everyone. If you look at the past 6 months, how many white police officers have either choked, shot, or ran over, or punched, and is seen on television?
Tased.
Well, look, a week later, we shot a guy 12 times. They had a knife in his hand instead of sitting in the truck talking to him. So how do you have mace that can spray at least 50 feet, but when a guy, you got a taser and a taser's three, you can't use a taser on a guy, you got to shoot him 12 times?
Or if you got to shoot him in the leg.
I know.
Apprehend him. Why you got to shoot the
kill? Well, they don't go to the range, so they have to shoot a lot to hit one time. I mean,
it
goes back to what I was telling you. We have different, because we are all social beings and we're whatever human beings, the social aspect, how would I treat you if I was you? How do you see me? If that's a white kid, if that's a kid, somebody you know, you shoot the wound.
Right.
Disable, not to kill. It's not automatic.
Right.
Or you try to talk them down.
Yes.
You try to bring some clarity and rationale in the process.
Right.
If I'm in a car and he's got a knife, how dangerous are you to me?
Yeah.
You know? Or I'm out standing here with a gun. You don't have to kill somebody.
Agreed, 100%. And the police fail to see that they have those alternatives, and that's the way they're trained.
If you compare, I did comparative police research in Germany and Britain,
There was a comment on by the Interior Minister in Germany talking about why the police hardly shoot any rounds in a whole year in Germany. 44 rounds was recorded in 2011.
Wow.
44 shots, okay? While at a Florida police stop, they got off to about double that rounds in one incident. And right here in Ferguson, what, about 13? 13 shots. And so police resort to using a gun too freely. And one of the reasons for that is that they normally do not have to face any consequences for that action. You know, you'll see the statistics, 95% got off scot-free, and over 98% in another study got off scot-free.
You know, one of the most moving things I've ever seen portrayed in television is the movie A Time to Kill. When Matthew McConaughey did that closing argument, even I was moved by that process. I've even used that in training sessions since that time and been effective. When he asked that audience to close their eyes, and that black child, he was describing all of the terrible things that had happened to that young lady, and he says, now, imagine she's white.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it changed the whole paradigm about the thought process. Immediately, it went from guilty to we've got to do something different to innocent. You know what I'm saying? We've got to get to that point. It's not easy.
James,
we've got to get to that point.
Do you have any more questions?
We do have another question from the line of Rick Gary. Please go ahead, sir.
This is not so much of a question, but I wanted to actually, being a vet, by the way, the comment about hiring vet and what a vet. Well, I think a veteran is probably the best qualified people, you know, some of the best people you can hire. And they're the stigma that may be used. In fact, it was the person who actually made that comment. That was the stigma. And I think that's totally unfair, totally unjustified. So I just wanted to, just clarify that just because you hire a veteran, that veteran does not have any more likelihood of doing bad things than anyone else. So if you look at the number of people who do bad things in society, far fewer percentage is far fewer vets. So I just wanted to say that to you.
I am the gentleman that made that comment. I'm a veteran. And
all right.
I am on a committee that is working hard to help those veterans that have mental illness get back into the workplace. Because right now what we're trying to do is get everyone off drugs. You have veterans on 13 drugs at one time.
Yep.
And we're trying to change that. Yeah, so yeah. I am a vet, and when I said that out of the concern of if there was a noise or anything that could take them back into an environment where they could actually have a reaction to it, it could have been deadly.
I understand that, but you know, there's a stigma now that's associated with veterans, and that, you know, just like the stigma so with black folks, that if one black folk does something bad, they all do something bad. So
right.
If one veteran does something bad, they all. So don't let that. I cringe to any kind of a broad brush associated to any group.
That veterans, I mean, there's a work ethic that veterans bring automatically to the table. And really that's been a positive effect on the workplace.
Yeah, because the corporations in St. Louis are honored by not just the veteran, but the structure that they bring to the workforce. Yeah. So I agree with you 100%.
That's something else I can get on, but that's another story.
Is it Gary? Mr. Gary?
Yeah, Rick Gary, yeah.
Gary, can I ask where you're calling from?
I'm calling from Clayton right now, but I live in St. Charles, and I get my offices in Cottleville, Missouri. Great place.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your
listening. And
no problem.
Thanks, Ken.
Chuck, you're talking about how you see the other person as your brother. I understand NPR had a program within the last 10 days about the police. I thought it was New York, but it could be someplace up east somewhere, that they have many homeless people who are mentally, emotionally disturbed, and they don't have them in the hospitals anymore. They kind of put them on the streets because they can't take care of themselves, and so et cetera. And they had an attitude towards anybody, you know, you're a troublemaker.
Yeah.
I need to handle you, you know, and so rough and tough.
Yeah.
Well, they were schooled. They had a training for these policemen. I'm not too sure where it was at. Did you hear this story?
No, I didn't hear.
But it's like, how do you work with mentally ill people? And they went from being objects to clients.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And said, then they taped the interview of two policemen working with a person who on the street, and they thought they were social workers.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was New York, but they had him stand down, and all of a sudden the problem kind of dissipated because their attitude had changed. They still only saw him as an object, as somebody to corral, as somebody to correct in a disciplined way. Rather, what they need from me?
Help.
They need from me to lean in to say, how can I hear your heart?
Right.
Yeah. So that just touched me very deeply.
Yeah.
And that just happened?
NPR had for the last 10, 12 days.
Okay.
I understand.
All right. Well, I think we're going to close it up on that happy note. And, James, were there any other questions?
There are no further questions.
Okay, very good. Well, I want to thank all of our listeners and those that engaged on the phone. Thank you so much for your questions. Very good points. Thank you to everybody in the room here for your time and your exchange here. It was very powerful. I'm really glad we recorded this because I think we'd like to make it available for others to listen to the discussion that you all had, which was it's certainly going to stay with me. Dr. Wolf on the phone, thank you for joining us and being part of our discussion. And I do want to thank St. Louis University's Department of Political Science and Washington and Venice University for their co-venture in making this possible. Thank you, everyone, may we continue to build an environment of understanding and turn away from the anger and try and improve each other's lives. Thank you so much, everybody.
You're welcome.
Thank you, James.
That concludes the call for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T Executive Teleconference. You may now disconnect.